Hello, welcome to the Shark Snippets podcast, the bite-sized podcast for anyone who loves or wants to learn about sharks, skates and rays. My name is Josh and I'm a marine biologist who specialises in shark ecology. So unfortunately I have been a little under the weather this week, so I do apologise if my voice is a little croaky and if there's the occasional sniffle throughout this episode. In this week's Species of the Week, I'm going to tell you about an elusive and unique shark known as the goblin shark. This creepy, distinctively looking shark is something that could and probably has fueled the myths and tales of sea monsters from old sailors. The goblin shark has a unique snout and coloration, and I'll delve more into these shortly. So, research to date on the goblin shark is few and far between. They're a very rare type of shark and not often caught or have been able to be researched. So, with very few individuals being seen, there is little or no information about their size, weight and age. Their average size is believed to be 1.6 meters or 5 feet. However, the largest recorded individual had a total length of 3.8 meters or 12.6 feet. And what's really interesting about this, or about the largest individual caught, is that it was actually a male. And if like the majority of other shark species, then it's very possible that the females could grow even longer. So one study has actually made an estimate on the maximum size, and that is between 5.4 and 6.17 meters, or 17.7 to 20.2 feet, which is huge and obviously a massive difference from, or a massive increase even from, the species or the individuals that have been seen and measured so far. Also, males are mature at 2.64 meters or 8.66 feet, but for females, the maturity size is unknown. So the goblin shark has been found in the Atlantic, Indian and Pacific Ocean, with most, or if not all specimens being caught or observed around a few distinct coastal areas. And these areas include Japan, Australia, South Africa, Portugal, and the United States. And there are a few more, but those are really the main ones. And the majority of samples or observations have occurred in and around Japan. So in general, the goblin shark has been found between a depth of 30 meters and 1300 meters, or 1,300 meters, which is 65.6 to 400 and, to 4,265 feet, which is crazy. It's really, really, really deep. And even that depth range is quite incredible considering the pressure change between those. So also another really interesting thing is that individuals under 3 meters, or 9.8 feet, have been found in shallower water and have not been observed below 979 meters or 3,212 feet. But all individuals over 3 meters or 9.8 feet have not been seen or collected in depths above 270 meters or 886 feet. And obviously there's a real limit in terms of the sample size, but if that's what's been found so far and that would essentially continue, then obviously there's a really clear difference between where the younger or smaller individuals generally are found or live in terms of the depth with the adult ones. So whilst the goblin shark has only really been seen in a few locations, like I stated, it is believed that as deep water fisheries expand and fish in new areas and possibly at deeper depths, then more of these unique sharks will be found. So in terms of the collection of species and the location, it is very limited regarding where individuals have been caught. And as, like I said, individuals have been caught everywhere, it's just kind of assumed that there is more of them than we've found. So the goblin shark, like I mentioned earlier, has a unique snout or rostrum, and this snout is actually overhanging, extremely elongated and very flat. Think of it as kind of half of a skateboard deck or even a horizontal arrowhead, which has been flattened. And just like the hammerhead cephalofoil, it contains many ampullae of Lorenzini, which are the gel-filled pores which link into an electroric reception sense. And this, again, just like the hammerhead, is believed to give the goblin shark a heightened electrical sensory system and allow it to detect prey more easily in the dark, dark depths of the ocean where it lives. And if you've ever seen a picture of a living goblin shark, which you may have, may not have, you'll notice that their skin has an almost pink coloration to it. And what's quite interesting is there can be quite a big range between this coloration. It can be quite bright pink, or it can be almost grey pink, and it varies between each individual. And what's really interesting is that the skin actually doesn't have any pink pigments within it, and it's actually this that their skin is translucent, and what we perceive as the pink coloration is actually the blood vessels, specifically their capillaries, carrying around oxygenated blood, which gives it that reddy or pink color. Additionally, their skin is apparently very soft and almost flabby to the touch, which may help them deal with the huge amounts of pressure that they live at the depths that they live. And a couple of other unusual features are their small eyes, presumably because, again, they live in the deep, dark depths where they don't really need eyes. And also they have large rounded fins. And they look like a rather cumbersome shark that probably swims rather sluggishly and a bit strangely. And finally, the goblin shark's protruding mouth. So the goblin shark is able to extend their jaws outwards from their body and essentially able to move their jaw independently, which is really cool and quite unique. And this makes for some really creepy footage. And there's a great snippet of this from one of the Shark Week episodes from, I think, a couple of years ago. And I've popped the link in the description of the podcast. And it's definitely worth a watch. So check that out. And you'll actually see just how the goblin shark's jaws extend. It's really, really impressive. So the goblin shark is listed as least concerned in the IUCN Red List, and it might come as a bit of a surprise considering how rare goblin sharks are. However, this assessment value is based on the fact that the majority of individuals that have been caught are small juveniles, and captures of adults are very rare. And with the majority of captures being in deep bottom gillnets or bottom longlines and trawl fisheries, it would seem that the deep water fisheries are currently not fishing at the depths where adult goblin sharks prefer to reside. And therefore, sexually mature individuals are not being taken and the population should be relatively unaffected. Again, if deep water fishing and fisheries start to grow and explore into newer territories, then this could potentially be something that would affect the goblin shark. Definitely go and have a look at the goblin shark. Just type it into Google and go look on the images, and you will be wowed by the sheer weirdness and maybe creepiness that this specific shark has. But yeah, have a look, let me know your thoughts, and if you'd like it. So time for Sharks in the News. So the first Sharks in the News article I'm going to be discussing is titled "Surfer Describes the Moment Shark is Spotted During J-Bay Competition." So for those of you that don't know or don't follow surfing, the current World Surf League, or WSL, International Surfing Competition is currently running in Jeffreys Bay, or J-Bay, in South Africa. So J-Bay is certainly one of the highlight locations during the competition for both the surfing athletes and fans alike. And actually myself have been to one of the competitions in J-Bay, actually 2 years ago, which was a year before the infamous Mick Fanning White Shark incident, which was at J-Bay. And I don't personally think it was an attack. I'm more of the shark investigating and seeing what Mick Fanning was, and then getting caught up in Fanning's leash and panicking. However, that's another story. Mick Fanning will probably say opposite to me. But 3 days ago, during the J-Bay competition, on the 5th of July, another white shark was seen in the area, and the article mentioned how US surfer Connor Coffin knew what it meant when he saw jet skis flying towards him. Essentially, the sign that there was a shark nearby. Subsequently, the water was cleared of surfers until the area was clear of the shark, and the competition resumed. So during these competitions, they obviously basically use drones to monitor the area and to try and spot white sharks, which I think is a fantastic method, and really highlights obviously how useful technology and consumer technology as well, something that we can, as consumers, can go and buy, and it's relatively inexpensive and provides a fantastic risk mitigation. But what's really interesting about the article is that it posts some of the comments from people on Twitter over the incidents, and highlighting those comments the article actually was highlighting the comments that mentioned how often there is shark-related incidents at the J-Bay competition. And even one of the comments was actually really interesting, because I didn't know this myself, but one of the World Surfing League stops, which was in Margaret River in Australia in April this year, was actually cancelled because there was a shark seen 10 kilometers away. And so it kind of begs the question to really say, like, how comes that competition was cancelled but the competition in J-Bay wasn't, when I believe the shark was more than 10 kilometers less than 10 kilometers, to the surface. So it's kind of a tricky one. I don't really, in all honesty, know the exact answer, but my kind of thinkings with this was possibly because of the recent state of shark attacks in Australia, it might have kind of caused the competition to be cancelled over than restarted, because with the large amount of incidents, the last thing in terms of, I guess, for the sharks as well as maybe tourism that area needs is a shark attack. So potentially just as a real completely remove all risk strategy, it was cancelled. However, it does seem, especially from over the years as well, that sharks are almost an expected competitor that is included in the J-Bay surf competition. However, I think the management strategy by obviously the World Surfing League staff and team, I think, was fantastic, because at the end of the day, look, we do share the oceans with sharks, and if some of the best surfing in the world is unfortunately in areas where sharks are present, whether it's white sharks or bull sharks or tiger sharks, I think mitigating and reducing the risk by just pulling the surfers out and then resuming, I think it's a fantastic way. It's a win-win both ways, because the surfers get to surf and the competition gets to continue, and the sharks can mind their own business and move on their way. So the second article is one which I'm pretty sure you all would have heard of or even seen, which is the woman in Australia getting bitten by a tawny nurse shark as she was feeding it off the back of a boat. So the clip and pretty much all the articles have gone viral. It's in every news and media outlet, pretty much online, as it obviously makes a juicy story, as was previously discussed in the last in the last episode. And It's easy to kind of see why it went viral as well in terms of the way that she gets dragged into the water. So first of all, not that I should really need to say it, but please just don't hand feed sharks. It's pretty simple. You know, if no one's going to go out and hand feed a lion or I mean, even some dogs, people don't hand feed. So you can hand feed stingrays, and there's a lot of that, particularly in the Caribbean, as probably a lot of you might have seen. And I just wanted to kind of differentiate that. But basically, stingrays, they don't necessarily have sharp teeth. Some species of skate do, so don't do it with all flat sharks, please. Especially don't say that I said that you could. But basically, stingrays have these plates, which they use as teeth. And think of them like a giant molar, like our teeth, like a giant molar, one at the bottom, one at the top. And what they do is they kind of grind on their prey and break it down, as opposed to piercing it and then kind of swallowing it whole like the majority of sharks do. And because these plates, they don't have sharp teeth on them, they won't actually lacerate your finger. I mean, they can bite down and potentially very hard and can still do some damage. So be wary. But yeah, it's not going to rip the skin unlike a shark. So the lady who got bitten, Melissa, stated this: "Please let me assure you all, this is not a shark attack. This is me doing a silly thing and suffering a consequence. The water is their domain, and we should appreciate and admire them from afar." So I just wanted to say kudos to you, Melissa, for coming out and stating this. It's very common for people to not and to claim kind of the victim and play innocent. And I have a lot of respect for her coming out and saying that. And it's incidents like this and with people coming out and saying this, which really kind of help dispel and disprove kind of what some shark attacks are and the exaggeration and that goes along with it. But unfortunately, as I did discuss, like I said in last week's episode, the press like to exaggerate the situation with their terminology, using words, for example, in this article, such as terrifying, attacked, and even crocodile-infested waters. So, I mean, just using some ridiculous terminology just to incite fear and terror into their readers and not necessary and including stuff which isn't really necessary. So will that stop? Probably not, in all honesty. However, aside from the bad journalism, remember, guys, watch and observe. Don't be silly and just use your common sense, please. No one wants to get bitten. It is one of my personal prides that with all of the amount of time I spent with sharks and handling sharks from tiny little babies or neonates from like 30 centimeters all the way up to 4 meter hammerheads or 3-4 meter tiger sharks, I've never ever been bitten, and that's something I pride myself in and will hopefully continue and never happen. So as always, the links for the articles in the Sharks in the News section are in the podcast description, so if you want to go check them out, then please do. Also, if you guys would like to as well, just let me know your thoughts on the two articles, particularly the one with the woman getting bitten. So yeah, would love to hear your thoughts on that. Now for the Sharks in Science snippet. And this week it's going to be short and sweet and pretty straightforward from the title. So the title is "The First Record of African Angel Shark Squatina Africana in Indian Waters Confirmed by DNA Barcoding." So this study was led by M.N. Amberley with colleagues from the Central Marine Fisheries Research Institute in Kochi, India, which is near Kerala. And for those that don't know, angel sharks are a flattened species of shark that spends the majority of its time on the seafloor. And watch out for next week's episode, where one of the 19 species of angel sharks will be the species of the week. So in the introduction, the paper discusses the angel shark and mentions that the African angel shark has only been reported from the southwestern Indian Ocean between Tanzania and the eastern Cape of South Africa, where it's commonly found between 60 to 300 meters or 197 to 984 feet. So the sample in the study was obtained on the 28th of September 2016 during a regular fisheries observation survey. The specimen was caught in a mechanized gill net and taxonomic identification was carried out according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization species identification sheets. Additionally, a genetic sample or genetic samples were taken and morphometric measurements were carried out. So morphometrics are a series of fine scale measurements of every measurable part of a specimen, both internally and externally. The paper states the DNA extraction process and lists all of the morphometric measurements. And there are some great pictures of the uniquely shaped African angel shark and worth checking it out. Within the paper, there is a great table which shows the pairwise genetic distances between other African angel sharks, so those of the same species, and also other angel shark species. And essentially, the study found an average genetic difference of 1.76% between different individuals of the same species, which is the African angel shark, and compared to an average difference of 10% in other angel shark species. So that clear difference in percentage between obviously 1.76 and 10% really shows that this actually is the first example of an African angel shark in Indian waters, which is awesome and super, super unique. So this is a clear example that showing, despite technology and all of the research that's currently being conducted and has been conducted, there is still so much more to discover. And really gets you kind of thinking, like, some of these species, you know, that's a huge distance. So the increase in the geographical range is huge. So as the crow flies, it's approximately 4,400 kilometers or 2,734 miles. And if going via the coast, the difference increases to 7,400 kilometers or 4,600 miles. And, you know, that's a huge, huge distance and increase in geographical range. It essentially prevents a couple of issues as well in terms of if that species needs to be managed, it now needs to be managed over far more countries and a larger range, which makes it much more difficult. And also just note those distances might not be 100% accurate. It's just what I measured using Google Earth. But yeah, regardless, it's an amazing extension of geographical range. And I mean, if it's traveled that far, who's saying it's not even traveled more? I guess, well, hopefully more research will find out, but we'll have to wait and see. So I just wanted to clear up something from last week. And basically, if you listen to last week's episode, one of the news stories was about a great white being spotted off the Spanish coast, or specifically off the Balearic Islands, I believe. And I was really unsure from the initial picture and video whether it was really a great white shark or possibly a mako. Now, what's really interesting is I've been kind of following this on Facebook and on Twitter and across social media with other scientists, and there's a couple of key white shark experts, and they have come out and they've seen extra footage, high definition footage and better pictures, and they are 100% sure that it was a white shark, which is awesome. It's so, so cool, and I'm super glad that it wasn't a mako, like I honestly thought it was. So Yeah. So I just wanted to kind of update you guys and let you know that it really was, which is awesome. And fingers crossed for more sightings in the future. Maybe even some research on that population would be super interesting. But anyways, thank you very much for listening. Apologies again for my slightly croaky voice. And maybe any sniffles. I don't think there were, thankfully. But if you have any questions you want to put to me regarding the episode, or then please let me know via Twitter, via email. Again, links are in the podcast description. Thanks again for listening, and have a jawsome week.